The Oldie Lunch Recordings presents Andrew Lowney talking about his book, Stalin's Englishman, The Lives of Guy Burgess. Sponsored by Doro, number one in the senior mobile market.
And welcome to our three speakers. We have evolved, some of you will know this, a little ritual. I hope our speakers will permit me, and even if they won't, the parrot joke. And if you feel like joining in, please don't. Bear with me, speakers. The parrot joke. Excuse me. Welcome to the sound of mucus. A woman... woman went into a shop and saw this beautiful blue and gold parrot, and she said to the man, he's gorgeous. How much? She said, 20 quid. She said, 20 pounds? He's beautiful. He said, well, I've got to tell you, to be quite frank, he's got a bit of form, a bit of history. He was in a brothel, and to put it delicately, he's got quite an extensive vocabulary. She said, 20 pounds, I'll take a chance on that. So she took it back to her flat, took the cover off, and the parrot looked round and said, new place, very nice. And her two daughters walked in, and the parrot said, new place, new girls, very nice indeed. And her husband walked in, and the parrot said, hello, Keith. Now, what... enough, enough. My happy duty now, our first speaker. Our first speaker tells of espionage. A tangled web spread wide and large. Nothing here smacks of simplicity. A saga, rather, of duplicity. And his narrative rivetingly urges us on. If I merely say the name of Burgess, I... enough! 'Tis time my hand drew away from this introduction. You try rhyming with Lonely. 'Tis time my hand drew away from this introduction. Welcome, Andrew. Andrew Lonely.
Well, thank you, Barry. I haven't got any parrot jokes, but it's very nice to be invited. Thank you very much. And I feel very much the warm-up act for Belle, Mooney and Quentin. But I have a very interesting character to tell you about, so I hope that will be okay. And Quentin very kindly has said that I can speak for the next 45 minutes. So I thought I'd give you a whistle-top to store, really, of Guy Burgess's life. And then perhaps to ask one or two questions, or raise one or two questions, about why he did it, how he was able to get away with it, were there other spies? You know, should we be talking about the Cambridge Five or the Cambridge 50? I've lived with Guy Burgess now for 30 years. I first started, it's really been a ménage à trois. Indeed, my wife slightly got worried when I suggested we should call our second child Guy, particularly since it was a girl. Why is Guy Burgess the most interesting, and I would argue in my book, the most important of the Cambridge spies? I think partly he's interesting because the very wide range of people that he had contact with. If you think that some of his friends included people like Graham Greene and Stephen Spender, Frederick Ashton, Lucian Freud, George Orwell, Ian Forster, Maynard Keynes, he's very close to Churchill. He did a wonderful imitation of Ernest Bevin in bed with his wife Flo, seeing if they would recognize Red China. So you can imagine he's quite a fun person to write about because of the circles he moves in. And what I found researching this book was that actually he was the most important of the Cambridge spies. People think of him as the Joker in the pack. He's never really had a biography before. I'd like to class the Tom Dryberg book of 1956 as a work of fiction. I found as I talked to a lot of these Russian agents that they really respected him. They called him the moral leader of the group, the man who kept everything together. And he was, after all, the first of the Cambridge spies to be recruited by British intelligence. He was the third member of the group. The first, of course, was Philby, then Maclean. But he was also, as the private secretary of Hector McNeill, as Minister of State and the Foreign Office, pretty much at the heart of British policy making just after the Second World War. So when they were redrawing the map of Europe, we were creating NATO, we had the Berlin Airlift, all these things, Burgess was right there in the heart of government. And he always very kindly said that he would work late at nights and take documents home. And as a result, the Russians had 5,000 documents they released in 1980. But he was also, I think, a very important agent of influence. In his time in the BBC, he actually helped shift British opinion towards being much more sympathetic to Russia during the Second World War. And in the Foreign Office, as a senior member of the Forest Department, helped shape policy to recognize Red China at a time when, of course, that was not the policy of the states. But it's really a comic caper. And any of you who've seen Single Spies, or rather the play Englishmen Abroad by Alan Bennett, will have a very true picture of what life was like for Burgess when he fled to Moscow in 1951 and how he spent his life there. His brother told me a rather good story of going out to the funeral just after he died. And the woman at Thomas Cook paused for a moment when she heard the name Burgess. And she said, "Burgess, will that be a single, sir, or return?" But he is a very large and life character. I think he's a very intriguing character because half the people think he was dissolute, promiscuous, dirty, lazy. And others told me, and I interviewed about 100 people for this book, that he was incredibly intelligent and charming and very, very able. And I don't think he would have risen to the positions he did within the Foreign Office and the BBC and elsewhere. He wouldn't have had the friends he had if he hadn't been a pretty effective operator. I suppose the big question, as I say, is why did he do it? Why did this man at the heart of the British establishment seek to betray many of the values that he really believed in? I mean, he loved Jane Austen and the Reform Club. He loved picking up men at the top of Piccadilly tube station. I mean, none of these things really were going to be possible in the same way when he went to Moscow. And how did he get away with it? I almost called the book The Nine Lives of Guy Burgess, because every moment when he seemed to be caught doing something wrong, dropping documents in a pub and being helped to put them back in the briefcase by a policeman or whatever it was, he seemed to get away with it. And I suppose the conclusion I came to of why he did it is it's partly a political thing. He was very much part of that generation at Cambridge in the beginning of the 30s who felt that they had to do something, they had to stand up to fascism, and they felt that Russia was the only country that was doing anything. But I think a lot of it was a sort of private revolt, and this is where I suppose the biography comes into its own, because one's able to chart in the course of this book all the triggers and all the factors that may have made him or created the sense of being or feeling an outsider. To betray, you have to feel you don't belong. And I think that was, even though we would argue he belonged to the establishment, he never felt he did. He loved this sense of épater la bourgeoisie. He loved the sense of riding with the hares and the hounds. This deceit, in a sense, was all the way through, ran all the way through his life, both in terms of deceiving his partners, but also deceiving his friends. So it becomes a very, I think, intriguing look at class and politics. I mean, probably now, if the fact you've been to Eton and Cambridge would not necessarily let you off the hook as a spy, at that time, it did. There was no idea that anyone from the establishment could seek to betray it. So I think I've only done 5 minutes, Quentin, so I'm going to probably stop there, and then you can have a little bit extra, okay? So thank you very much.
The Oldie Magazine Recordings. This is a Radio Gorgeous production for The Oldie 2015.